I will call the meeting. And we have two sets of minutes. One from February 21, one from February 26. Would somebody like to move the minutes?
So move.
Our friend Dean moves both sets of minutes. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? So the two sets of minutes are approved. And before we get going, I want to remind members that we have a 24-hour rule for amendments, and today we have two amendments that didn't make that rule, but they're relatively brief, and I'm going to allow them to be heard, but in the future, I'd like to take a little tougher approach so that we don't run into problems, and almost both of these today could have been done as oral amendments, one of them is a little longer. So if you just keep that in mind, that I'd certainly like to have 24 hours so that all the members can look at the okay, the first bill is House File 357. Representative Mallory is here, and since he's not a member of this committee, I will move that House File 357 be recommended to pass. And ultimately,
Representative Mallory, do you want to present your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And I understand you have an amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Do you want to do that first?
Why don't we do that first? It's okay. A relatively minor.
And Mr. Chair, I apologize for not meeting in 24 hours, but I didn't get it until actually when I talked to you yesterday. Within about 5 minutes of my getting it, it was triggered actually by a question by one of the Republicans at the last committee, and so basically it just says that before the state money goes out to pay the agency has to use any other third-party reimbursement sources, like if there's private insurance or something like that, then that has to be used up so we don't use up our state money when we don't have to. And I think everybody would agree to it. And Mr. Chair, since the bill's staying in your committee, either you can take as amendment now or you could put it on as an amendment.
Well,
later.
Why don't we put it on now? And I would move the A1 amendment that simply says that the commissioner has to seek third-party reimbursement before the commissioner pays for something.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So, any discussion of that amendment? Yeah. And so, all those in favor of the A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. So the A1 amendment is added to 357, and Representative Mallory, present your bill then.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Basically, what we found out is that if you get quick intensive treatment after or during the first psychotic episode, we not only help the patient by getting them help right away and lessening their problems, but we also save a lot of state money and insurance money. And so Ms. Abderholden from NAMI will explain the details, but that's basically what the bill is about.
Okay, Ms. Abderholden, welcome to the committee, and if you would just state your name for the tape and present your knowledge of the bill, which I assume is exhaustive.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Sue Abderholden from NAMI, Minnesota, and I won't be as exhausting as I normally can be. I do want to point out that early identification and evaluation of the onset of psychosis is an important healthcare concern. Early detection and intervention improves outcomes. Psychosis is a symptom or set of symptoms and is defined as the experience of loss of contact with reality and is not part of a person's cultural group belief system or experience. Estimates place the risk of psychosis at about 3 in 100. Psychosis typically involves one of two major experiences. One is hallucinations, and they can take the form of auditory experiences such as hearing voices, less commonly visual experiences, or more rarely smelling things that others cannot perceive. You need to know that the voices are often critical and even threatening. These are not nice voices in your head saying that you are a good person. Delusions is the second major symptom. Then those are fixed false beliefs. They can take the shape of paranoia. For instance, I'm being chased or followed by the FBI, or a mistaken identity. So a young woman may say to her mother, "You're an imposter, you're not really my mother." What makes these beliefs delusional is that they don't change or modify when the person is presented with new ideas or facts. Delusions are often associated with other cognitive issues such as problems with concentration, confused thinking, and the sense that one's thoughts are blocked. Young adults are the most common age group to be at risk for their first episode of psychosis, and the experience impacts them at a developmentally vulnerable time. This is a stage of life that usually challenges young people to develop more independence, establish an identity, create intimate relationships, and move away from the nest of the family home. Typically, young adulthood focuses on the external world and friends, and while parents often serve a valuable but less central day-to-day role, yet if a young adult is having problems organizing his or her thinking or is distracted by hearing voices, functioning at a high level of independence will be problematic in many cases. Psychosis often impacts individuals in college years, and the culture in a college setting is not typically geared towards seeking help. Having a psychotic process separates the individual from peers and can impair their social connections. The loss or threat of loss of social connection adds to the stress to the person experiencing these symptoms. It's often very scary and activates feeling of shame when one is having them, and it makes it so difficult to focus and discuss. This leads to isolation and may reinforce the power of the inner experience as withdrawal from external contact occurs. With a young adult away at college, parents may think they're supposed to keep some distance in order to support independence in a college-age child, and they may not have adequate information in order to appreciate the onset of psychosis. Psychosis requires intervention as soon as the person or the family realizes the seriousness of the situation. Early identification and treatment are important in order to have good outcomes, and we need to make sure that we are providing intensive services. You've heard me say this before, but when someone has cancer, we don't say, "Come back when you hit stage four," but we absolutely do when it comes to psychosis. We let people be hospitalized over and over and over again or end up in our jail system. These intensive supports, which are noted in the bill, include therapy, medication management, social skills training, stress management, working to improve cognition. You might have seen the article in the paper recently about the computer games that can really help someone improve that cognition, support groups, psychoeducation about their illness so that they accept it, and help with finishing their education or staying employed. Our national office actually conducted a survey in 2011 of people who experienced a psychotic episode and their families. When asked who was helpful, 22% said no one, demonstrating the extreme isolation people face. One person said, quote, "It's the most soul-wrenching experience anyone can go through. Use every resource to get through it and then turn around to help those coming up the mountain after you. They need your help." And they do need your help. This project would help by providing the services and supports that are needed. It would help by reaching out and educating, particularly the healthcare community, about psychosis and what to do. Last night was the annual NAMI research dinner where we collaborate with the University of Minnesota to learn about what new things are coming down the pike to provide hope to individuals and families. And one of the things we learned that is every time someone has a psychotic episode, they lose 1 to 2% of their brain volume. And if you think, even just, you know, on NPR yesterday, the poor man who was in the Hennepin County Jail had been hospitalized multiple times in a short period of time with psychotic episodes. You know, he's just becoming more and more disabled every time he has an episode. I think this is a really important bill. I think it would really provide those interventions that we need. And I'd like to now have you hear from Sue Hansen, Mom.
Ms. Hansen, welcome to the committee. And would you state your name for the tape, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sue Hansen. I'm a member of NAMI Minnesota, and I'm also the parent of a 38-year-old man with schizophrenia. All of us get phone calls at one time or another that change our lives forever. One of those calls for our family came on May 1st, 1995. Our youngest son, Joel, was 20 at the time. He was a sophomore at the University of Minnesota. We knew things had not been going well for him that year. Even though he had always been an honor student, he was struggling with each and every one of his classes. He was finding it difficult to get to class. He couldn't get the work done. We even had one professor send us a note asking us if Joel could be on drugs, which he was not. And then I heard Joel's voice on the other end of the phone telling me that he had run into his evil twin, and they would be leaving to go to another planet. They would come back for us in a few years, but for now it was just going to be them. Now, I'm Joel's biological mother, so I know there's no twin, evil or otherwise. So I knew we were into some serious trouble here. And thus, our journey with serious mental illness had begun. We were absolutely devastated. We had a picture, or we thought we had a picture in our heads of how to handle health care situations. My husband has had a serious auto accident, and he had many internal injuries. He's also had cancer. Our daughter has had type 1 diabetes since she was little. I've had a couple of surgeries myself. But nothing prepared us for mental illness. The stigma that surrounds it makes it more difficult to talk to other people about it, and it's even more difficult to find information and resources to deal with it. If you add to that the mental health system, most families don't know where to turn. It's been a very difficult 18 years. For the past 13 years, our son has been in the system. Over a 10-year period, he was hospitalized over 35 times, and who knows how many trips there were to the ER. Some of his hospitalizations were for a couple months, some as short as 2 weeks. He spent 2 6-month stints in Anoka Metro. He lived at home, in hospitals, on the streets, in group homes, and in assisted living. He overdosed seriously twice, the second time ending up on life support and intensive care. And he's overdosed many other times as well. Securing housing for him has been and continues to be one of our biggest challenges, next to keeping him on medication. Just about the time we think he's settled into a new group home or assisted living situation, some funding is cut and he loses his housing. After all, he is only mentally ill, so it is even more difficult to keep services for him. We have had a case manager from the county or ACT, Assertive Community Treatment, and we work with them on a constant basis. But the day-to-day burden falls mostly on families. Joel constantly looks for work, and occasionally he even gets a job. But the jobs never last more than a couple weeks. His illness prevents him from acting appropriately or being able to work for more than a couple hours at a time. I have no idea how much this has cost the system. It's well into the hundreds of thousands of dollars, probably more, actually. About 3 years ago, we were able to put together an array of services that seem to have made a huge difference. He has an ACT team, assisted living, and he's on a caddy waiver. He has not been hospitalized in over 2 years, a real accomplishment. It's finally working, sort of. He may lose his housing, and he is definitely being turned over to other case managers. He's losing his ACT team. So, can we change this picture? If someone had given us information at the time of Joel's first psychotic episode about his illness, about what's available for him and for us, I believe it would have made a huge difference. Psychoeducation for both Joel and for us, someone coordinating his care, peer and family support groups, wow, this would have all made a huge difference and made many of the things we had to learn through trial and error so much easier. We would have understood the illness better, understood what was needed earlier, and we maybe would have been able to get him into stable housing much sooner. I hope other families don't have to wait 16 to 18 years to receive the help they need. This bill can help consumers and families deal with mental illness much earlier and much better. It will save money and years of anguish for both families and those with serious mental illness. Thank you.
Okay. Are there questions? Representative Awer.
Oh, okay. Well, we can fight about who gets to go second. Thank you for coming. I just I can't imagine. Do you mind if I ask just a math question?
No.
Was there, because your testimony is compelling, I didn't want to undo that because you've had a hard, long time. But what kind of funding stream was he on? Was he on CADI or something? Or maybe Ms. Abderholden would know. How do we help these folks with housing and programming anyway?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, a lot of it's been, once Joel finally got on medical assistance, it's been the various programs under MA that have helped, CADI waiver being one. But there's always, kind of this weird thing that goes on with the different programs saying, well, now that you're better, now we're going to move that away, even though that's what's keeping someone stable. And then saying, well, you can't have too many programs at once, which is one of the problems that is happening now. And again, it's still cheaper than hospitalization, but we run into those problems. But mainly it's been medical assistance.
Thanks. And just Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
One of the complications we ran into before trying to economize and so on is that, and some of the department proposals even have been to, some of the people on the low end are there because we're supporting them, and they're a day away from being on high end. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
Individuals like this get on to SSI?
Joel has been on Social Security Disability for, I believe, 13 years. So he does get help.
How long did that take you to get
him? It took me 18 months to get him on.
A lot of paperwork.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hansen, you mentioned earlier that perhaps if you were able to notify this or identify this earlier in his stage, perhaps things would be a little better outcome for you and your family. So with that, I'm asking the author of the bill with some of the details of how to identify psychotic symptoms and how you identify first psychotic episodes. Where is that done? How is that done? How will this bill identify that? Is it done through the educational system? And then is that information private then between the parents, or are they notified? How do you identify that in an early stage to captivate that client or that patient before it becomes an adult in a more troublesome situations?
Mr. Chair and Representative McDonald, since we have an expert on that, I would think you'd learn a lot more from asking Ms. Abderholden. I know a little bit about it, and I've worked on this some, but she's the complete expert.
Ms. Abderholden.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McDonald. It's a couple things. One is making sure that primary care physicians understand what those first warning signs are. And actually, even in Oregon, there was a project where they were educating, especially high school students, about, as part of their kind of healthcare curriculum, about some of the early warning signs of psychosis. And they actually had young people coming forward saying, well, I am hearing voices. And so getting that early identification again so people are more aware of it. But a lot of primary care will tell you they don't really know much about psychosis. So if they know, they can also be on the lookout for those kinds of things. In terms of what happens then, we've always said that HIPAA doesn't require us to be stupid. And so there are ways that physicians can work with families on this issue. We actually had a bill several years ago for our college systems to say that a mental health crisis is the same as a healthcare crisis. So if a young person is hospitalized for their mental illness, the family would be notified just as if they would be notified if they had appendicitis or something like that. And so we need to make sure those laws are working well. NAMI actually, through a private grant, is funding a program called Allies in Recovery to help mental health professionals know that no one gets through a serious illness by themselves, and they need to figure out a way, engaging the person so that they have other friends and family involved in their life so that they can be supported in the right way. I don't know if that helps answer your question.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, it did, Ms. Abderholden, because I was just... I had a concern with the in the bill where it says that funding special projects. So I wanted to know what special projects those are and how you identify them. And then we have a serious issue, of course, with mental health. As you know, you've educated me in my 3 years here. But I think whenever you have a bill that has unspecified amounts of money to put towards very important programs, it was caused concerns for all of us, of course. So I was just wondering how you fund special projects, what those special projects are, and what the cost of those are. And is it quicker to identify those and more cost-effective for the course for the state and more better for the families if you do it early on and then in education? And if it's in education, is that done through the school systems and some of those details? So is that a fair question?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McDonald, great question. So a couple things. One is, in terms of the special projects, we've been working with the department to say, so what would that amount be for one project per year? We think it's around $250,000 for each year in this project to fund some of those things that insurance doesn't pay for and to help young people who are uninsured or underinsured. I think that actually Medicaid expansion will really help some of those uninsured kids be able to get access to some of that treatment in terms of it being billed. And that's why we wanted to put in the language to assure you that they would bill private insurance and Medicaid for whatever could be recovered. In terms of identifying kids early, I think you'll remember the schooling to mental health grants and hopefully the expansion of those. And because most adults with serious mental illness begin experiencing symptoms before the age of 14, we may be able to catch young people earlier in, especially, you know, you usually see psychosis before 14. It's usually a little bit after that. But particularly in high schools, you might see a kid who's all of a sudden starting to do poorly in school, has an inability to concentrate, is starting to isolate themselves. And so with the schooling to mental health grant with those mental health professionals, they would be able to then help that young person and be able to identify them and intervene early. Teachers are wonderful screeners. They know when things aren't going well with the kid in the classroom. And so having the professionals there to be able to refer to really does help a lot.
Representative McDonald.
And then lastly, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I certainly like to support this bill. Of course, I recognize the importance of it, but to the author, because there's an unspecified amount, I would presume this will be considered to be laid over for inclusion, and at one point we'll know the cost of this bill to fund some important programs.
Representative.
Department. I'm sorry, it's indecisive because it's not exactly on topic, but just the conversation that you're having brings to mind, you know, all the kids go through this DARE program in fifth grade, and they learn about drugs and alcohol, and I just feel like that is sort of the age where kids maybe need to be introduced to the concept of mental health and mental illness, and, you know, they're taught to look out for things, and I think if we want to get at the stigma, and we want to get to the point where people can ask for and get good treatment and without the stigma being in the way, I think part of how we can get past that is getting kids to understand that there's two components of health. There's mental health and there's physical health. And I just wondered if you had any feedback on that.
Well, Mallory.
Mr. Chair and Representative Fortman, as she said, there's a bill which I believe it first went to Carlos's committee, and it's mental health is in for children, youth is in my committee, but the schools part is in Carlos's. So it went to Carlos' committee, and we're working exactly on what you're suggesting is needed to both inform kids as soon as they can realize and think that through about what mental health is. It's just like, you know, if I get sick with my finger or whatever, and that it's normal. And so kids need to realize that so that they don't do stigma, and also they will help each other. And at that point, it also trigger them to where this bill that NAMI has would put a lot more services on mental health into the schools, so there's access. It's a way to get a hold of kids right at that time when this becomes an issue and they start to realize it. So it's a great bill, and we hope you'll support that one too.
Ms. Abderholden, often these things show up when kids are college age. And is that because they weren't diagnosed earlier, or is there some scientific reason that it hits about that age?
Mr. Chairman, there is some scientific evidence that it's around that age, but if you ask some families, they might say, you know, looking back, there were a few things that were happening in high school that we just thought was part of being a teenager. You know, I mean, teenagers are sometimes difficult to figure out. having had two of them.
Really?
And so, you know, sometimes you see things and go, well, it's just part of that stage. And then they get to college. And the other thing that happens, too, is we know that serious stress can impact it, can be kind of a trigger. We also know that if marijuana, which I know people think can be really safe, actually NAMI's psychiatrist at the national level has made every kid he knows promise that they won't smoke grass until they're 25 because it really can impact their brain and trigger psychosis. So, you know, there's a lot of things that happen when you're away at college at 21. You're, you know, all of a sudden you're not the brightest kid in the classroom anymore. You're, you know, maybe someone's doing their laundry for the first time, managing finances. All of those things can really cause that stress. And we think there is a genetic link as well. And so you add that and psychosis appears.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we touched on it a little bit, but I would say that, you know, adolescence and that transition, I know younger children with, you know, the normal imagination and that sometimes, but when they hit adolescence, is there any special things that, I guess, counselors, teachers, et cetera, are keyed to look at that might, you know, you were saying that they're distracted, their grades go down. Well, I know, you know, a lot of adolescents, that's sort of what happens when, you know, the hormones hit and they start changing. So is there any program now to try and have, you know, here's a sheet of things to look at and just not peg that they are, but maybe allow for a discussion with the parents or the student or a counselor?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Quam, actually in 2005, a law went into effect that requires teachers as part of their continuing education to have training on the early warning signs of mental illness. And so we really talk about it in terms of a thermometer, you know. So you may have a fever and it may be nothing, and that's kind of like with teenagers. It may be you're seeing some stuff that are concerning, but it turns out to be nothing. But you want to at least have that conversation. And I think with the... you know, if a teacher sees a concern, they can report it to the school support personnel, like school social workers, school counselors, school nurses, who can then maybe talk with that child, and then bringing the family in to say, so what's also happening at home, which is a really big part, too. Some kids, when my daughter was depressed, I saw it not only at home but in school. Putting the two pieces together, we decided this wasn't normal development, that there was something else going on, and so that connection and partnership with the family is really critical. And then if everyone agrees that maybe there is something going on, then you can hand them off to a mental health professional who can do a diagnostic assessment and say, yes, this is what I think it is, or no, I think it's really just a stage that they're going through.
Okay, Representative Quam.
Thank you. Just one follow-up in that, as your teachers, you know, you have a student and the teachers do, you know, discuss a little bit, you know, they have their new class list and students coming in. When they see something, each person's an individual, are they also keyed to look at, you know, the delta from, you know, if a child's been a boisterous child all the way through and now they're quiet, it might seem normal when they, you know, were a little bit out of the normal. So is that part of the parameter? And that was the last thing I was curious about.
Ms. Abderholden.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Quam, you know, it's obviously a little difficult sometimes in a high school if that teacher's never seen that child before. But, you know, they rotate through different classes, and we always hope that a place isn't so big. But we've even noticed in the school mental health grants, a fairly high percentage of children are actually referred by their families who are concerned about what they're seeing. And so, you know, by allowing everyone to kind of have input into what's going on with that child, I think we are able to identify kids who do need services, and then, you know, the rest of the kids can, you know, move on just fine.
And I'd like to welcome the 9th and 10th grade students from the Great River School who are here, I assume for the day, looking at the Capitol and the state legislature. So welcome. And Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks for the testimony. My question pertains to, I understand, you know, there's the mental illness concerns, okay? Every family's been affected, I think, in one way or another, as far as relatives and those types of things. But when I look at the school, and having been a school board member, and I observe the process, it seems like, you know, giving a pill for the problem is the easy solution. And, you know, some of the negative side effects of the long-term drugging of children, I think, needs to be taken into consideration. And so how do we, I guess, is there a check and balance and second opinion in the process of diagnosing a mental illness versus a behavioral problem? It seems to be a gray line, and from my perspective, it seems like the pill is the easiest solution, sometimes for everybody concerned, rather than trying to get to the root of the problem. And again, a lot of these medications, these psychotropic drugs for young people, carry long-term severe consequences. Even our military recognized that. And so are there some, I guess, I'd like to see some checks and balances before children are automatically put on these medications and easily diagnosed with a mental illness problem versus a behavioral problem or an eating problem or who knows what it might be. Would you like to respond?
Abderholden.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Grunhagen, you know, the beauty of the school-linked mental health grants is that you actually have mental health professionals who don't have prescribing privileges who are coming into the school. So they're actually providing that more intensive long-term treatment, you know, therapy visits numbering 20 or 24 versus just simply providing a pill. I mean, I would agree with you that you can't... A pill for any illness usually doesn't work. You have to look at a whole lot of other things in terms of, you know, even, you know, diet and exercise and, you know, different types of structures, different types of, you know, parenting a child who has a serious mental illness is a, it's your usual tricks don't work, and so you need to learn some other tools, and the child needs to learn some tools too to control their anxiety or their depression. So that's why we really wanted these clinicians in the schools, so that they're not just going to, I'm not going to pick on family practice docs, but going and then, you know, their option is to kind of give them a pill.
Yeah, just one follow-up. Yeah, I appreciate your answer on that because, you know, I've looked at the criteria just as a layperson. On some of the diagnosis, and it does seem to have a lot of subjective factors in some of the criteria. And I guess I'm more interested in objective facts than subjective judgment calls by a professional. Mm-hmm. Before we medicate, I just think we need to put some real safeguards, and medication needs to be looked as a short-term and a more of a final solution than the first thing we think of. And our society is pill happy, by the way, but I understand that. But anyway, that's just my food for thought.
Representative Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Abderholden, to get back to Representative McDonald's question regarding the cost that we don't have, how would you relate, say, the cost of early intervention and the savings that we'd have as a result of early intervention as opposed to what the upfront cost would be for this program?
Ms. Abderholden.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Newton, I'm not a math major, but I can tell you we would save boatloads. You know, just thinking about, you know, Sue's son, Joel, in terms of, you know, each hospitalization day is about $2,000. Then you talk about, you know, medication costs and the therapy costs and then the housing costs, his reliance on Social Security and not working. I mean, all of that adds up. We have let him, frankly, become disabled. And not every mental illness needs to result in becoming disabled. And so we know there's a small project right now at the University of Minnesota. Dr. Schultz was able to come and speak at Representative Mueller's committee, and he talked about they've actually helped young people because they've intervened early. They finished the high school, they finished college, some of them are working, so we're really helping them not become disabled. And anytime we can do that, we save lots of money.
Thank you. Okay. Yeah. Any other questions? Representative Mowry, do you want to have a final comment on your bill?
It's a great program. It will save the state a lot of money, so fund it.
Okay. And with that, House File 357 is laid over for, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus finance bill. Next, we have, thank you, Representative Mowry and Ms. Abderholden and Ms. Hansen. Next, we have House File 663, Representative Lane. Well, not welcome to the committee because you've been here every day.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move House File 663, and I have an amendment.
Let's do the amendment first.
Okay, it was originally oral,
and
but
the pages have copies.
I understand it's been drafted.
So we're going to do the printed version. But you can talk about the amendment while they're passing it.
What this amendment does is change the funding source. Instead of using the newborn screening fee and a hospital fee, we're just switching it to the general fund. So it makes the bill much simpler.
So you're not going to raise the newborn?
We're not going to raise the newborn screening fee. The Department of Health would like to clarify that that revenue goes directly to screenings and would like to not have much follow-up services coming out of that. They'd like to focus it specifically on the screenings, so we're not going to add to that screening fee. This bill is about additional follow-up services.
Okay, so do you want to move your amendment?
Is it the A? I don't have it.
The A1.
A1 amendment. I move the A1 amendment.
Any discussion of the amendment? Does everybody have a copy? Looks like it. So all those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So,
okay.
Representative Lane.
So all that's left in the bill that you had before you is Section 2 and then the appropriations. And Section 2 just speaks to having follow-up services, and the appropriations are below. So let's see. We have this is about families that are born, have a newborn that is deaf or hard of hearing, and 94% of these babies are born to hearing parents, and they have no idea how to approach this. So with support, these children can actually have the early critical language development similar to their hearing peers, and that's what we would like to support. I do have here Mary Hartnett from the Commission of Deaf and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans to carry on.
Ms. Hartnett, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Mary Hartnett, and I'm the Executive Director of the Commission of Deaf, Deafblind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans. We're a non-cabinet state agency that advocates for and with people that are deaf, deafblind, and hard of hearing to develop public policy solutions to barriers faced in education, healthcare, employment, technology, civic engagement, and access to public services. In 2007, Minnesota was at the bottom of states in its screening of children with hearing loss in the United States, according to the CDC. By conducting a survey of hospitals, we learned that they didn't screen because it wasn't a mandate. They had so many mandates that they had to follow that hearing screening went to the bottom of the list if they couldn't meet those needs. Our commission led a coalition of diverse stakeholders, including audiologists, pediatricians, parents, and members of the deaf and hard of hearing community, to pass not only a mandate, but evidence-based supports for families once the baby is identified. These practices were drawn from the Joint Commission on Infant Hearing that is appointed by the CDC. You have before you a blue chart that shows all of the bills that were passed in 2007. And first, I want to absolutely thank Representative Lane for introducing this legislation, but I want to also want to thank the chair. It was very hard to get this many bills passed in one session. We were creating an infrastructure, a platform for these babies. And in the final negotiations, Representative Huntley made sure that every one of these pieces was there. So thank you, Representative Huntley. And I want to thank Representative Abler for signing on to almost every one of these bills. So thanks. Because it really is, it is the platform. It's the floor that we need to make sure that babies are successful. You made a big difference in looking at what is needed when a baby is identified with screening. They need to be screened by 1 month, diagnosed by 3 months, and have intervention by 6 months, and then they have a chance at having typical language development. The 35 years or 40 years after the first special education laws were passed, the research shows that kids are graduating with about a third to fourth grade reading level. Only 1 year's gain within 35 years. And hearing screening is a game changer for these kids. It came in about 10 years ago in the rest of the country, and Minnesota got caught up in 2007, but actually had a voluntary pilot that was bringing us forward. And kids need access to auditory information, so we got a hearing aid loaner bank put in place so that once a kid is identified, they have access to immediate amplification. We got parent-to-parent guides, so and they'll be explaining their wonderful program because parents really listen to information from other parents with hearing loss. And we had a small pilot for a deaf mentor program, only $40,000 to get that off the ground, so kids could have visual language. It's an evidence-based practice in their home. And then we have a robust advisory committee that informs the process, that's tracking the progress of the system, and that is putting practices and best practices in place for audiologists, for physicians, et cetera. And then we had a Part C coordinator to make sure that all the babies that were identified, the big jump that we were going to see, were coordinated within the Department of Ed. So all those pieces are in place, and everything was going well. And how are we doing from 2007 to 2013? We were only screening about 80% of the babies before, and now we're screening about 99.1%, a big success. We still have a lot of work to do to make sure that all of the babies are getting the interventions they need, but we're here today to talk about two of those supports. The research shows that babies with a child with a hearing loss listen and learn best from other parents, and that children with hearing loss are not provided with rich visual language models and are assistive listening device, assisted auditory-based language input. They will reach preschool with severely impoverished, if any, language skills. The deaf mentor programs and parent guide programs need additional funds. Thank you, Representative Lane, for offering this important piece of legislation. The state now spends $30 million a year on 2,500 kids who are deaf and hard of hearing. These modest investments will ensure their success. We thank you for your time. I would like to just maybe raise an issue a little, to talk a little bit about the follow-up services are really essential, and we hope that this amendment doesn't mean that the department isn't interested in continuing with follow-up services. So just want to, this was new to me, so I just want to make sure that the follow-up services that are so critical for the child's success are continue to be part of the infrastructure of the Department of Public Health. Thank you. Now we have
any questions for Ms. Hartnett? Well, thank you, Ms. Hartnett, and then now we'll go to Ms. Lindahl Davies. Welcome to the committee, and state your name for the tape, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Candace Lindahl Davies, and I'm the mother of a 17-year-old son who's profoundly deaf. I'm also the coordinator of Minnesota Hands and Voices at LifeTrack Resources, a parent-to-parent support network of Minnesota families with children who are deaf and hard of hearing. Today, I ask for your support for an increase of $200,000 in funding for our program, totaling $450,000 in funding per year. Minnesota Hands and Voices has existed since 2000, and for the past 12 years, Minnesota Department of Health has contracted with us to contact families with children newly identified with hearing loss in order to provide unbiased parent-to-parent support throughout the state. To do this, Minnesota Hands and Voices built a network of trained parent guides in each of 7 regions, offering families local support from parents who have firsthand experience navigating the medical and educational system, making complicated decisions for their children, and accessing community resources. Harnessing the passion and experience of parents, we complement the early hearing detection and intervention system by ensuring new families are emotionally supported, return for necessary follow-up healthcare appointments, and are linked with early intervention and have access to language development and adult role models. Our program has been an overwhelming success, and educational professionals refer their most complicated cases to us. And unlike school district employees, parent guides can provide parents with the full range of choices for their child, and we are not tied to any communication modality or educational methodology. In 2011, we successfully contacted 94% of all families identified through newborn hearing screening. In 2012, of the 964 unduplicated families we served, 261 of them were families of newly identified children, a 43% increase in newly identified children over the prior year. While we are thrilled to have this many children identified, we struggle to keep up the significant increase in demand as our 12 employees total up to just 3 FTEs statewide. While we are certainly sensitive to the state's current financial crisis, we respectfully ask for an increase in Minnesota Hands and Voices funding proportionate to the increase in referrals. This funding would permit us to hire a full-time parent guide and part-time culturally specific bilingual parent guides. While corporate and foundation grants have helped support this project, consistency and continuation of the program requires a public investment. The cost savings and reduced special education of identifying and intervening with one child with bilateral deafness, according to the CDC, is $4,500 per year. Add to that savings in unemployment and underemployment, and the cost savings increases dramatically. We cannot afford to not reduce our long-term costs. Therefore, we ask for your continued investment in the future of our children who are deaf and hard of hearing. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and thank you, Representative.
Any questions? I don't see any, so, we're going to have testimony from a parent. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Chair and committee members. I'm Danelle Gunaris, and I come from the Deaf Mentor Family Project and Program. Our Deaf Mentor Family Program is at LifeTrack Resources, focuses on the communication needs for families with children who are deaf and hard of hearing from birth to age 6. Intervention with ASL for deaf children is for them to acquire language skills during their critical period of language development to prepare them for the readiness and language-based needs for them to enter school ready to learn the curriculum and the material. The Deaf Mentor Family Program assists families by providing instruction in ASL, early visual communication methods, and deaf culture training through a trained deaf mentor. This is our curriculum here. The Deaf Mentor Family Program provides intervention and a benefit with the benefits of training skilled deaf adults who can then become a role model and an ASL teacher for a child who is deaf and hard of hearing and their hearing family. The deaf mentor would provide the child a language model that would remove any language barriers and language delay issues. This curriculum was developed based on research when an interventionist noticed that a deaf child that arrived into kindergarten had minimal or no language. Deaf children that come from deaf parents arrived to kindergarten with an equivalent language base as children that come from hearing families, hearing children that would come from hearing families. In front of you, you do have a chart in your handout. And that's our Deaf Mentor Project chart. On the second page is where you will see it. This chart would explain to you and reflect the three different categories that you see there. You'll see a hearing child that comes from hearing parents and their language development. You will then see a deaf child that comes from a hearing family that had the benefit of a deaf mentor, and then a deaf child that did not receive those services. You'll see the comparisons there. It will reflect the language development. Of course, a deaf child that comes from deaf parents or hearing parents has their natural language development. Without the Deaf Mentor Project, they were not able to develop the language readiness in order to enroll into kindergarten or had the language base. A child that had the benefits of a deaf mentor developed their English and had their language base and entered school ready. With those results, it has shown that the Deaf Mentor Services has benefited positively for those children who were developing English skills at a rate much more than children who did not receive those services. In 2007, the state funded $40,000 to the Deaf Mentor Program, that $40,000 was enough for us to serve 8 families statewide. Only 8. Last year, LifeTrack Resources was awarded $100,000 for the Deaf Mentor Program. But within 7 months, the Deaf Mentor Program is at capacity. We've been limited to serve only 20 families. We've reached capacity within 7 months. We continue to receive applications from families requesting our services and requesting to be a part of this program. But again, we are at capacity. So we now have a waiting list. So we are requesting for an increase in funding for our Deaf Mentor Family Project of $200,000. And that would cover our families who are on the waiting list. And our program is also growing. I thank you for your time, and we request that you support this bill. And I can answer any questions if you would like me to.
Are there any questions? I don't see any, so thank you very much for your testimony.
Mr. Chair.
And Representative Lane, do you have a final comment on your bill?
Yes, I was just thinking as we went through this that I would call your attention to, we've had a lot of discussion over the last few years around brain development, and I know that to use the example of cats, if we take a kitten at a certain age and cover their eyes and then remove it after the critical age for visual development has passed, they can never see the rest of their life. And it isn't that there's anything biologically different in their brain or in their nerves or anything. It's just simply that you have not had that critical stage of development exposed to the experience of learning. So here we have these youngsters who, if they have the opportunity for language development in whatever way that it works for them, they will develop the language development that they need to go on in school. But without that, they miss that critical period.
And it looks like we have another testifier, so if you'd like to.
Yes, Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Laura Libby. I am the mother of a 5.5-year-old deaf son. He was identified at birth, and the audiologist that we worked with gave us a bunch of information, and one of the things she gave us was a pamphlet of Minnesota Hands and Voices, and I went home and wasn't sure what I should do, and I ended up calling them, and I'm so glad I did. I think it was the best phone call that I ever made in my life. I found out they had a parent guide program, and I was assigned a guide, and this was a woman who also was a mother of a child who was deaf or hard of hearing, so she really understood everything that I was going through. And I'm a new mother, first child, my child is deaf. I had no idea what to do. No one in my life that understood. There's no one in my family who's deaf. It was completely a surprise. I've never known anyone who is deaf, so if I tried to talk with my friends or my family, they just really did not understand what I was going through. And she was there at first to just give me comfort. I would just call and cry, and I was really distraught and felt completely hopeless. Like, here's my child who I thought, you know, would be normal hearing child, and now will he ever speak? Will he ever say the word mom? Will he ever go to college and do all the things that I thought he would do? And I thought there was no hope. And she really got me to see that there was hope. She told me about her child and all the things that she had been through, and then I realized I wasn't alone, and was just there to listen to me. And that was so important because I needed the strength, and she gave me that to move on and do all the things that my son needed me to do for him in this time when he needed to learn language and he needed to be developing, and it's been quite a process. And then as I was talking to her more and more, as I needed the emotional support, it turned into resources and other things that she was giving for me. All of a sudden, we were talking about communication options and things that I never even knew about, cochlear implants, and I didn't even know they existed, and now my son has one. But I needed to know these things fast so that I could be doing these things for my son as he needed them. And also, Hands and Voices had a connection with other families who had been through similar things, so if I needed to talk with them to know okay, I want to talk with another family whose their child has had a cochlear implant and now they're 7 years old, and how are they doing, so that we could make that decision. Or if I wanted to talk with other families who use sign language or other things, you had to make these decisions fast as your child is developing. This is that critical period where they need to have language, and we wanted our child to have all that language and to not be behind. Then she also told us about the Deaf Mentor Program, and we went through that. And that was an amazing program because we were working with our school district, but they did not have anything that was like the curriculum the Deaf Mentor Program had. And to be able to come in to a family like mine, they had a curriculum already ready, specifically geared toward a family that's hearing, that's now had a deaf child. You need to be able to learn that fast to communicate with the young child, for the young child to be able to get language really quick. My son did not have the implant at that time. We needed to make sure that he was getting communication. He did become a candidate for the cochlear implant surgery while we were working with the deaf mentor, and our mentor did happen to have an implant that she got as an adult, so we were also able to talk with her about her experience with the surgery. So not just the parents that I had through Hands and Voices that could tell me how their five-year-old was now doing, but now I could talk with her. I was scared to death to have a one-year-old child that I was going to have this massive surgery that they're going into his skull, but she could tell me what it was like for her, and that made it a little less scary. And she could talk about what communication options and things were like as a deaf adult. And that also gave me a lot of, and my husband, a lot of hope. And part of the deaf mentor curriculum was to expose us to the deaf community. So she gave us a kind of a background on all that that's in the curriculum. And as my husband and I felt more comfortable with ASL, we then went out. She told us about some events, and we got exposure, and we went to some things, and we talked with some members of the deaf community, and it really just showed us what was out there, and I think it was just invaluable, that something we couldn't have gotten anywhere else. Like I said, Blake is 5 and a half now. He is doing wonderful with sign language. He is doing wonderful with his cochlear implant. He's getting ready to go to kindergarten next year, and we're getting ready to mainstream him, but ready for all options that he might need. If we need interpreters to come in, we're ready, and it'll be a lot more seamless. I think this will cause the whole system to not have to pay as much in the long run. He won't need as much pull-out sessions. He won't need extensive speech therapy. It's going to be a lot less services. And I'm hopeful at this point that he will be a fully productive adult. All my thoughts that he'd be able to go to college and do whatever he wants to do, I think that is completely within the realm of what is possible for him, and he won't need extensive services as an adult. So I think funding these kind of programs and allowing a child like Blake to have these kind of successes when they're this young is really saves you so much money in the long run, and it allows just for the healthy development of that child. I think he's going to be a fully totally included member, and he's going to feel that way, that he's not behind and that he can do whatever he wants to do, and that's just invaluable. So thank you.
Thank you, and Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Some of you know, because I've talked about it when I've had other bill hearings, that this was an area, the birth to three in particular, was an area I worked in another lifetime, and it was before Representative Huntley and others, Ms. Hardin, had the laws changed. So I know what it's like to be on the other side of this when there aren't services for parents, or you're scrambling to provide services for parents who have an infant or young child that's been diagnosed. So I think this is fabulous. My question is really probably to Ms. Hartnett, but although maybe Representative Lane can answer it. I've worked with LifeTrack before in some other areas, and I know them to be a kind of a Twin Cities-based organization. I'm wondering if you could talk about how these services are done outstate to Rochester or rural Minnesota, as we look at the map and we have, you know, all across the state diagnoses throughout the year, every year. How do we provide these services long distance?
I will call my lifeline.
Welcome to the committee. And would you state your name for the tape?
Certainly. Trixie Ann Goldberg with LifeTrack Resources. Thank you for the opportunity, and thank you for the question, Representative. LifeTrack Resources, in fact, provides many statewide services, and it has become very, very effective in working not only through a network of partnerships and working with locally based organizations, but having remotely located staff and parent guides who are living right in the communities with our families. So we've been providing statewide services for over a decade now. now. And that network, again, has proven to be extremely efficient. As you notice, we're running these programs for with very, very minimal overhead. And so by using all of the resources across the state, working locally so our families can have immediate access, and also using the latest technology, we've found we've had extreme success, whether we're working with a family here located in the metro area or located in Grand Rapids or any other community in the state.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Lane,
I think
do you
done.
Have a final comment? Or would you?
I think they've presented it very well. Thank you.
Okay. McDonald, Representative McDonald has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question for Representative Lane. Many in my district believe that as important as a state is that we help those who are born with hearing impairment. And I think it's a great use of our resources. It's very important. And I believe I have the responsibility to represent them and to carry on good legislation that helps do that. So I'm in support of the efforts. And maybe staff can help me with my question when it's, it deals with the appropriations. And it says on the bill, blank appropriations. But then I read other areas that increases the fee from 106 to 116. So can you just clarify that for me or Representative Lane when it mentions the blank appropriations in fiscal year 14 and blank in 2015? Was that the amendment that was corrected then?
Right, Mr. Chair.
Representative
Lane. Mr. Chair and Representative, the amendment takes care of that. The amendment adds the appropriations and it does not any longer go on the fee.
Representative McDonald.
That satisfies my question. Thank you.
Okay.
Sorry I missed that.
Chairman, okay. With that, this bill is laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus finance bill.
Okay. Thank you.
And as amended. And next we have Representative Liebling, who just ran up here from another committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and that's kind of the nature of the beast this time of year, right? Mr. Chair and committee, I would like to move House File 689, that it be recommended to pass and laid over for consideration in the omnibus finance bill.
Right.
And before we get going, members, I'd like to move the 9-8 amendment, which should be in your packets. And just to get the bill in the shape in which we would like to discuss it, and it's pretty simple, it just changes the date.
Okay, all that does is change the date from 2014 to 2013.
Correct, Mr. Chair.
Or the, All those in favor of the 0098 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, so the amendment's adopted, and Representative Liebling.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And members, this is a really important bill because, ironically, my bill that some of you heard, the Prematurity Task Force bill, which is a bill I have in another committee today, but basically what we're doing is we're trying to do better by our newborns in the state. And we know that by improving the health of our newborns, we can save a lot of human agony and a lot of cost. And this deals with fetal alcohol syndrome, which I'm sure we don't have to tell you a lot about, but if babies who are exposed to alcohol and drugs in the womb sometimes are born with very devastating medical issues that are just devastating over their lifetimes and also create a lot of cost in our budget and to across the board. So this is... This is a bill to expand a program that's been running in my county, Olmsted County, where it's had absolutely terrific and demonstrable results. And this was previously funded. The last couple years, the funding from the state was not made available. The county board decided to continue this, kind of struggled to find the funding for it, but continued the program for a couple of years on property tax dollars, as the county has to use, and just has produced terrific results. The bill before you is an attempt to expand that pilot program to not only to refund the Olmsted County portion, but to make it go statewide and expand its reach. Because what this basically does, and I'm going to let my testifiers speak to it more specifically, but it provides for intensive home visiting services with women, pregnant women, or new mothers who are at risk. And there are very few things we do in Health and Human Services where we can immediately track the cost savings. But because this deals with an intervention during pregnancy, and then you can count how many babies are born healthy after the pregnancy, you can really demonstrate the economic value of this program. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to my testifiers, and then I'll be available for questions.
Welcome to the committee, and will you state your name for the tape?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I am Sarah Messelt, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Organization on Fetal Alcohol Syndrome, MOFAS. Thank you so much, Representative Liebling, for all your leadership on this issue. 8,500 babies are born every single year in Minnesota prenatally exposed to alcohol. Prenatal exposure to alcohol causes brain damage, physical defects, and it's the number one cause of preventable developmental disability. The tragic irony, of course, is that this is 100% preventable if moms don't drink when they're pregnant. Prenatal alcohol exposure has a profound impact on our society. The human cost is obvious, and the financial impact is huge. One parent we work closely with at MOFAS has kept track of how much her adopted daughter has cost her county and state, and she reports the total cost of services for her daughter at the age of 20 has been $1.7
million. $1.7
million for one child in one county in Minnesota for a disability that was preventable. There is a direct link between prenatal alcohol exposure and the current challenges we are facing as a state and a nation. People living with FASD need foster care, they need PCA services, CADI waivers, mental health services, DD case management, and special education. You know better than most the cost of these programs. Most women, when they're given the clear information that they shouldn't drink during pregnancy, choose not to. But if you're dealing with addiction, it's just not that simple. I met a young single woman last week when I visited a treatment center in St. Cloud. Let me just tell you her story very briefly. Amanda's 21 years old, and she's pregnant with her third child. Her first two children were removed from her shortly after their birth because of a positive alcohol and drug test at the time of their births. She is desperately trying to turn her life around and be a good mom, chemical-free. But the cards are stacked against her. Imagine Amanda's life as a young pregnant woman who is facing the gripping hold of alcohol. Add in financial challenges, an abusive boyfriend, lack of education, limited family supports, and the guilt about her other children, and it becomes easy to see why Amanda needs more than willpower or hope to remain chemical-free. The cycle repeats itself over and over again, and without the resources and tools available in her community, like the program in Olmsted County, there's literally very little that can be done until child protection intervenes once the child is born. And then the services kick in with the child who's facing a lifetime of challenges with brain damage and needs for school supports and supports into adulthood. The program we are interested in funding in House File 689 go to the very core of this problem. This program looks at multiple complex needs of women who are struggling with addiction during pregnancy and provides a way for women to receive the support they need and lead healthy and productive lives. The current DHS women's recovery programs, like the one that the program Amanda was in, are available in 8 counties in Minnesota. This program would improve the outcomes if we could expand the program like the CRAFT program across the state. As the former First Lady Susan Carlson states in her letter that I shared with you today, this is a smart program, and I urge your support to support this common sense program that will make a life-changing difference in the lives of our fellow Minnesotans. Thank you so much for this opportunity. I urge you to support House File 689.
Questions? I don't see any, so let's go on to the next testifier. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and representatives. I'm Ann Lansing. I'm a certified addictions RN, and I supervise the CRAFT project. This is a program that's been in Olmsted County for a number of years, and we serve women who have problems with alcohol or drugs, who are pregnant, and who are parenting children under the age of two. This program's been in effect for a number of years. In several years, we've had all the babies born in the program that are drug or alcohol free. The program lost funding and restarted in January of 2012, and in that first year, we served 23 women. This year, we currently have 20 women involved. It's not just a program that is short-term. It's a program that is pretty intensive case management. We have an action team that oversees our program, and it's got representatives from corrections, social services, child protection, the hospital, social services departments, the legal system, so that we have ways of means of collaborating and working with all these different resources. It's interesting that I do chemical dependency and treatment, and from the office we only see a small segment of what's going on in any individual's life. But from the case management, where we're doing home visits, where we're taking women to their prenatal visits, where we're getting them to the pediatrician or to their psychiatric appointments or their mental health appointments, we see them, and we see them a lot. Twice a week, we have groups, and they are not treatment groups. They are, I don't know whether you want to call them group support groups or education groups. Twice a month, we have someone from PAIR, the Parents Are Important in Rochester. A parent educator comes in and talks to the women about parenting issues. And the issue depends on whether they're dealing with behavioral issues, what they're dealing with developmental issues, or potty training. It's what's important to the women. We have an early childhood educator, and this has been a blessing to our program, because she is trained in doing preliminary evaluations of the child's development, their speech, their behaviors, their fine and gross motor abilities. In the past year, even though we've been up and running for only a little bit over a year again, we've had three children already referred for further evaluation of deficits in their developmental growth. This early childhood educator goes out and does home visits with the parents, helping them understand what's developing in their child, providing them with activities they can be working on with their child so that their child continues the development, and so that the mothers have a investment in doing things with their child that helps them continue to grow and prosper. We work with corrections. We work with the public health department. We work with child protection. Right now we have 20 women involved in our program. Only three of them right now are pregnant. Last year we had six babies born. We are serving not only those 20 women, we have five women who are graduates of the program who continue to come back to the group for support and help with behavioral issues with their children. Of those women, right now we are serving 33 children. Most of those children, 26 of them, are under the age of four. We have seven women who are currently in chemical dependency treatment. We have four of them working part-time. Three of them are working full-time. This is new since they started the program. We have eight women who are involved with Child Protective Services. We had 13 children in foster care this week. Two of them are reunited with their mother. So we have all but two of those 20 women have mental health issues as well as chemical dependency issues. And all of those women who have mental health issues are either currently seeing a psychiatrist, a therapist, or both. I know numbers are just numbers, but each of these women has a face. You heard the previous testifier talk about some of the issues. We see this day to day. We see the chaos in the homes, and it's hard to parent a child who may be born with behavioral problems when you're a single parent, which most of our moms are. When you are not employed or not fully employed, where your family of origin may not be able to give you very healthy support, where you are trying to parent one or more children and you haven't had any good modeling for parenting. These mothers universally want to be good moms. They just may not know how to do that. And that's where we come in with education and encouragement and assistance. I don't know if any of you have tried to make it to a doctor's appointment when you had to get yourself and three kids on a bus and then have the appointment and make it home again. We help a lot of those women be consistent in the care that they need. I'll tell you about one lady briefly because I know there's a lot on your agenda, but I'll tell you about Carrie, who was in her early 20s and had a baby. And at the time she entered CRAFT, she was living with her boyfriend, who was the father of her child, and his family. And she was continuing to relapse to use over and over again, and obviously that didn't go over well with her in-laws. She was feeling overwhelmed. She had mental health issues. This young lady eventually moved out into the home with her grandparents, which is a stable setting. She's had mental health counseling. She, at the time, had only supervised visits with her child. Now she has shared custody of her child and has her child when she's not working. She's working full-time. She now has a driver's license. Some of our women come into the program without even completing high school. Right now we have one that's getting her GED, and all the rest have at least a high school education. So this is a program that makes a difference, and it really works well with the other services in the community so that we can collaborate and have a better picture of what's truly going on in a home and better idea of where the client's struggle is and where their successes are. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I just have one question. Do you interact with the Zumbro Valley Mental Health Clinic?
We are not associated with them, but we have clients that do go there for some of their mental health services. We get our clients in wherever we can get them in and where they're willing to go.
Other questions? Representative Grunick.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, just a quick question. Say this to the author, Representative Leaving. I do appreciate the fact that you put an 8% lid on administrative costs, which means more of the money will get to the people who actually need it. So I sincerely appreciate that. The other question has to do with the bill itself. On lines 1.8 and 1.9, it says the grant money dispersed, at least $360,000 must go to Olmsted County. Is there a particular reason for that?
Representative Leadwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Grunhagen, for the question. This, as you heard, this was an Olmsted County project, which was defunded. So initially, I have really two bills. One is just to refund the Olmsted County program. So this is a bill that attempts to both do that and provide funding to take this statewide. And I, you know, as you know, the process here is that all of this gets taken, laid over for possible inclusion, and ultimately the committee will decide how much money is available and what goes where. So these numbers are certainly not etched in stone, but as a representative from Olmsted County, my first interest was to get this going again, because as you've heard, it's so critical, it's been so successful, and we don't want to lose this program now. But secondly, it's such a greatly successful program that it really ought to be expanded and be available across the state, because obviously it's a problem that exists, I'm sure, in everybody's district. So if I could, I'd like to even spread it further and have more money available for it, but this is kind of the next step.
Thank you, Ms. Chair.
Okay. Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question on the bill. Paragraph C, it talks about the report that needs to be turned into the commissioner. And I'm just wondering, as I'm trying to think this through logistically, if a grant recipient is trying to reach out to a woman who is clearly at risk of, and their child's at risk of fetal alcohol syndrome, I guess I'm wondering, it says on there that one of the things is the report has to include toxic-free babies born in the previous year. And I'm just wondering, a lot of times I'm imagining once they get to the woman, damage has possibly already been done, and at that point it's trying to come alongside them and then meet the needs of the child and the increased needs after they're born. And I guess I'm just wondering, how often do you have women where they are, in fact, you get there early enough where they are, in fact, toxic free by the time they're born? I guess I'm just wondering, you know, I don't know if the legislature will get this report or who will get this report, but if they're not seeing any toxic-free babies born, but there are other things being accomplished through coming alongside a woman in distress or helping that child who's developmentally challenged. I guess I'm just trying to think through the logistics of that, because how many babies do end up being toxic-free as a result of your intervention, that you get to the female early enough where there's no repercussions from any damage that's already been done?
Mr. Chairman, and thank you for the question, Representative. We often, most of our children, the goal is to have them born drug and alcohol free. Obviously, in last year we had someone who started the program when she was over 6 months pregnant,
yeah,
and her baby was born positive for marijuana. The goal is to stop fetal damage as soon as we can. When a baby's born, its brain's like soft set jello. And we can't undo damage that's been done. But realistically, when you hold a baby, care for it, rock it, talk to it, nurture it, that kind of thing, you are stimulating that little brain that's like soft-set jello to develop. And the brain has this wonderful capacity called plasticity, which means that if we stimulate with activity, with communication, those kinds of things, that sometimes the brain can form pathways around the damaged area. So even if we have a child that's born with damage, it's not a permanently broken child. We have the opportunity to prevent further damage and possibly to help that child maximize the growth it can. And I think that's important to understand, that just because we didn't get them, two of them, in the earliest part of pregnancy, it doesn't mean that we've wasted the effort.
Representative Lee Wayne, we have one more testifier.
Yes, we do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I understood Representative Mack's question to be sort of more about, are we measuring enough to show the real value in case the toxic-free baby isn't the only measure? And
exactly.
You know, I hear the question. I think certainly there could be other measures, and we don't have a lot of time now for this, but it's certainly something I will think about and talk to people about. So thank you for bringing that up.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and representatives. My name is Stephanie Podolke, and I am a commissioner from Olmsted County. I don't need to repeat everything that's been said very eloquently. Initiative has been very successful in our county. This is one of those things where in 9 months you can measure it and you know what's happened. We've had on average 16 babies born drug-free to mothers who had been using alcohol and drugs per year in Olmsted County. If I was a group home manager and an in-home family therapist for many years, I can tell you firsthand, seeing the loss to individuals and to our society when children are born with FAS. I think all of us went into this into government because I think we have a deep faith in the possibilities of human potential, and that is lost when we have an FAS child born. I think we also have a deep faith in social change, which we can easily do with this initiative. If we extrapolated the cost to just to Olmsted County over 5 years for possible one child with FAS syndrome, we could have spent over $300 million over 5 years on those kids. So, and most of that money is state money, education and Medicaid money. So this is a win-win situation for everyone. And I know your time is limited here. So I said something to our lobbyist, and she told me I should repeat this to you. I told her that if this initiative passes, I could die happy and go to heaven. That's how important I think this is. Thank you.
That's the biggest pressure I've ever had put on. Are there any questions? Okay, I don't see any, so Representative Liebling, a final comment?
Well, just thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and I hope we'll be able to find the funding to include this in our final budget.
Okay, so House File 689 is laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, and as amended, and I have an announcement about tomorrow's meeting because of the fiscal forecast. Some of us have to leave, so we're going to start at 10, the usual time, and finish at 10:30, and we've canceled or delayed two of the bills, and so we'll only be dealing tomorrow with Representative Norton's bill on autism. So with that, the meeting is adjourned.